Hello and welcome to the first 2016 episode of Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you had a wonderful and relaxing holiday season. In today's show, we're going to take a look at some of the biggest stories from last year and their significance this year. We'll highlight topics such as predictions for the Brewers in 2016, the biggest bands we know are coming to town this year, as well as the upcoming elections. Before we delve into those topics, I talked to crime reporter Ashley Luthern in December about the violent year Milwaukee had experienced in 2015. Since we spoke before New Year, we didn't have the final number of homicides in Milwaukee for the year. That number, unfortunately, came out to 145 homicides, making 2015 the city's deadliest year in recent memory. Here's Ashley talking about what was done in 2015 to try to curb violence in the city and how those efforts will continue into 2016.
By the end of 2015, Milwaukee will record probably close to 150 homicides. That's a level that hasn't been reached in the last decade. In 2005, there were 122 homicides. And this increase is alarming to, obviously, people in the community, elected officials, law enforcement officials, and a lot of people are searching for solutions, and they're trying to pinpoint why there was this increase in violence. It is worth noting that several other cities, such as Baltimore and St. Louis, have also seen really sharp increases in homicides. It's hard to tell if it's a trend, though, only for 1 year. Criminologists say you should have several years of data before determining if this really is a new crime wave.
What were some of the factors they think might account for the upturn in number of homicides?
There are a lot of different theories about what might be driving this increase in deadly violence, whether it's more available access to firearms, whether it's changing in police strategies, whether it's perhaps relationships between the community and law enforcement being exacerbated by high-profile shootings by police, you know, whether that's something that occurs in Ferguson or something that occurs in Cleveland or something that occurs here in Milwaukee. Fairly or not, law enforcement everywhere tends to be judged by incidents that happen elsewhere. There's a theory that perhaps already strained relationships between community and law enforcement that are historically strained by, you know, deep, deep historical problems, whether that's segregation, poverty, lack of educational opportunity, might be further strained by these high-profile incidents.
What was done in 2015 to try to curb violence, and what will happen in 2016 to extend those efforts?
So what you saw in 2015 was a big announcement by the state attorney general, Brad Schimel, to lead a gun violence task force. He is putting two prosecutors with the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office that will focus primarily on gun crimes. They also set up what had been known as Gun Court, and that handled all sorts of types of crimes involving guns. That is now primarily the Shooting Court. For people, the charge usually is recklessly endangering safety. And now, among five other courts, that's where all the other felon in possession charges are going. So that was announced and really came online last month, and you're going to see a lot more of that and a lot more involvement from federal authorities, we've been told. Federal prosecutors, the FBI already works with Milwaukee Police Department on its regional gang task force. You're probably going to see a lot more activity from federal and state officials and working within city limits here. We'll probably start seeing specific cases come out of that in 2016.
As a reporter, when you have these numbers coming in of stabbings or shootings, how do you keep track of them all? How do you sort through this information? What kind of sources do you use?
So I use a variety of sources for information. I get information from the Milwaukee Police Department, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office, the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office. We also get information from the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. I mean, they are set up to really dissect the causes of homicide here in the city and who is likely to be a victim, who is likely to be a suspect. And we track that information in a spreadsheet, and we upload it online. We have our homicide tracker. I am really, really excited for an update to that tracker that we're planning to launch in January of 2016, which will hopefully provide our readers with more detailed information, and we should be able to also link victims with suspects who have been charged in their cases. So people can follow court cases easier, and it would just be a better landing page for that information.
And what would you say is the hardest part of your job and the most fulfilling part of your job?
I think the hardest part of my job a lot of days is feeling like I'm missing something. You know, crime is something that happens all the time in varying degrees. And you worry about, if I spend all this time on one story, what am I missing? Or what do I not know about because maybe I'm not in touch with the right people? You know, I want to be a resource and I want to be someone that community members, law enforcement, anyone feels like if they have a tip, they can pass that on to me. Or if they think something's important, I want to be their go-to person. And I just know that in a city as big as Milwaukee, in a state as big as Wisconsin, there are always stories that we're missing. And so that's one of the most difficult parts is choosing what to cover.
And then the most fulfilling part of your job?
The most fulfilling part of my job is telling people stories. And it really is something we've been able to do with our Precious Lives partnership, where we take the time and we get to know people who have been touched by violence in a very real way, whether they themselves have been injured in a shooting, or maybe they lost a parent to gun violence, or perhaps they were abused as a child. You know, we're telling these stories in a very real way so that readers can connect with them. And I find it most fulfilling when those people who have allowed me to tell their story come back and say that they found it to be a good experience and a fulfilling experience for them as well.
To find Ashley's work, including her Precious Lives series, visit jsonline.com/crime. In entertainment news, we may not know all of the Summerfest headliners yet, but we do know a few of the big acts headed to Our Fair City in 2016. Reporter Mary Louise Schumacher sat down with music writer Piet Levy to get a feel for the music scene this year.
So, Piet, we're heading into a new year, and that's a really good time to kind of think about your beats and what's ahead in the coming year. So let's just start with, in terms of your beat, the music beat, what are the big shows that you're looking forward to in 2016?
Yeah, well, I mean, confirmed for sure is Bruce Springsteen. He's coming with the E Street Band on March 3rd at the Bradley Center, and this will be his eighth show at the Bradley Center. He's done the Bradley Center more than any other artist, and there's certainly a special bond or connection in Milwaukee with Springsteen. Not that there isn't elsewhere, but, you know, there's this very famous show that happened 40 years ago, kind of known as the Bomb Scare Show. It was his first time in town, and a bomb scare was called into the Uptown Theater during the show, and everyone evacuated, and people were just kind of hanging out in the cold, and Springsteen went to the Pfister Bar and got a little tipsy with the band. He came back, and people could tell he was tipsy and had these kind of funny stories, and there was this bartender who, he was retelling the story from this bartender, and the bartender asked Springsteen, "Are you loose, son?" or something like that. And now, you know, Springsteen mentioned that at that show, and then for 40 years since, people, there's always someone who screams, "Are you loose?" whenever Springsteen plays a Milwaukee show. It's just this kind of continuing thing. Yeah. And he did the Harley Davidson anniversary, the 105th in 2008. But he hasn't been in Milwaukee since 2009, so I think there's a lot of extra excitement around this show. And he's touring behind The River, which is one of his best albums. Yeah. There's this really well-received kind of elaborate box set that just came out. And he'll probably play a lot of River songs, if not the whole thing.
And who else is coming this year? What are the other big shows?
Well, that month will be big at the Bradley. You've also got The Who was supposed to play in October. And that show was announced like a full year in advance. And it's part of their 50th anniversary. But they had to postpone due to illness. Their whole tour they had to postpone due to Roger Daltrey's illness. So they're finally coming through March 21st, I believe, at the Bradley Center. So that'll be a big one. And this summer, Kenny Chesney is playing at Miller Park on June 18th with Miranda Lambert and Little Big Town and Old Dominion as well.
I think Maroon 5 was on one of your lists at some point, too. Is that a big deal?
Yeah, that is, too, because they haven't been here in a while either. In fact, when they played last, it was on the Summerfest Miller Lite Oasis stage, which probably speaks to how far they've come now, their arena level. And that show at Summerfest was right after The Voice had just started, The Voice featuring Adam Levine. He's a judge on there. And that show kind of really gave him a big resurgence in terms of the popularity around the band and around him. It really launched them to that arena level status. So they played the Summerfest show like right after that show ended, The Voice ended. And the Miller Lite Oasis stage was just packed with people. It's just so crowded. There's more people there probably than even for the Marcus Amphitheater headliner that night. And they haven't played an official public show since then. They did like a private show at the Bradley for Northwestern Mutual employees. Yeah. But this is their first show in Milwaukee, a public show since then. It's been years. So mm-hmm. there will be a lot of excitement around that, too.
Is there one show that you are especially really looking forward to reviewing yourself?
The Springsteen show, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that would definitely be on the top of my list. And I'm really excited about that one because, you know, I admire him a lot, but I've actually never seen him live. Mm-hmm. This will be my first time seeing a Springsteen show. Yeah, which is like kind of shameful.
Unfortunately, we didn't have the time to include all of the acts who are coming in town in that segment. If you're interested in finding out more, find Piet's work at tapmilwaukee.com. 2015 was a big year for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's business staff, with coverage ranging from the growing number of apartments in Milwaukee, a strike at Kohler Company, and more. Reporter Brianne Shasso interviewed three business reporters, Tom Dakin, Rick Rimmel, and Rick Barrett, about the biggest stories that crossed their desks in 2015.
Tom, what were the biggest stories you covered in 2015?
Probably the biggest is the new Bucks Arena, both for the basketball team as well as other things that'll happen there, concerts, Marquette University basketball games, and the like. That's a $500 million project, and is by far the largest single project that's currently occurring in our area. $250 million of that is financed publicly by the state, by the county, by the city. And the process of creating that public financing package took months for it to occur. The status of that project is it's now all been largely approved for the financing part of it. The Bucks now have to do a couple of things. They have to get design approval through the city of Milwaukee, and they also have to reach a lease agreement with the Wisconsin Center District. That's the public agency that operates the Wisconsin Center, the Downtown Convention Center. It will actually own the arena, and then it'll lease it to the basketball team. And negotiating that lease has been occurring now for a couple of months and probably will continue into the first couple of months of 2016.
What else has stood out?
Well, we've seen apartment development increasing for the past couple of years in downtown, in and around downtown Milwaukee, as has been the case in other cities. Milwaukee is just part of a national trend where you have people in their 20s and 30s who are a little more inclined to live downtown than previous generations. And so most of the apartments that are getting built tend to be aimed at those folks. They tend to be a little higher end, and the rent tends to be higher than average. Some of these units are aimed at empty nesters, people who, you know, are in perhaps their 50s and 60s, whose children have grown up, have left home, and now they're looking to downsize into a smaller living unit. But I think it's mostly the millennials who are driving that development. And we're seeing like literally hundreds of apartments being built in and around downtown Milwaukee, other communities as well. I would say Wauwatosa has seen quite a bit of development. There have been now projects that have surfaced in the past year or so in Brookfield, in West Dallas, St. Francis, other communities that are geared towards that same population. But I'd say the vast majority of it has been downtown, East Side, Third Ward, Walker's Point, even into River West. And even just within, roughly a half mile or so stretch of North Water Street, if you start where the North End, that's an apartment development at Water Street and Pleasant Street, and then you go upriver, you've got something like, around 500 units that are coming online. You've got the North End, which is expanding right now as we speak. The latest phase of that is going to open in the early part of 2016 with a Fresh Time supermarket in that building as well. Just across the street from the North End, there's an apartment building that's being developed right now called The Rhythm. And then further up Water Street, right after you go past Brady and go past the Holton Street Viaduct, there's now the first phase of another apartment development called River House that's being built there, right overlooking the Milwaukee River. So there's a lot happening just within that small area, and there are other projects we could mention in that area as well. But there's a lot of demand for new apartments. It's probably the single biggest type of new construction that I cover right now, much more so than offices or condominiums or other forms of commercial development.
Thank you, Tom. During our discussion, Tom also brought up ongoing development of Milwaukee's lakefront area as another big story he covered in 2015. Examples include the Northwestern Mutual Life Tower, which has an expected completion date of 2017, and 833 East, a building being developed by Erkins. That's expected to be finished by March. There's also the possibility of Johnson Controls building an office building down in that area. That's currently being studied. Headlines were also made this year when union workers went on strike at Kohler Company. It was the first at the company since 1983. Here's Journal Sentinel reporter Rick Rimmel, who covers retail and general business news. Rick, tell me about covering the Kohler strike.
Well, the Kohler strike was pretty extraordinary, really. For one thing, there are almost no strikes of this magnitude in the United States anymore. Or I should say the number of major strikes in the country has been dwindling. I think there were 11 in 2014 involving 1,000 or more workers. We had almost about 2,000 at Kohler. There hadn't been a strike at the company since 1983. And there's sort of a general perception that labor doesn't have a very strong hand to play in these situations. And in fact, generally speaking, that's true. That's one reason the number of strikes has declined so sharply in the United States.
How long did the strike last?
32 days. Not a long time. About twice as long as the 1983 strike that they had there. It looked like things were pretty entrenched on both the company and the union side. But, of course, there was activity behind the scenes. And eventually, after about 2 weeks of no talking, the two sides started negotiating again. And gradually, in kind of a back and forth roller coaster sort of style, they came to an agreement that was almost unanimously accepted by the membership.
What was the membership asking for?
Well, there were a couple of things at issue. One of them was, you know, pretty straightforward economics, finances, and that's the cost of health insurance coverage for employees. The larger and the most remarked upon issue was the company's desire to keep a two-tier wage system that they had enacted in 2010, which paid newly hired employees significantly less than existing employees, even if they were doing essentially the same work. The union hated this. They wanted it scrapped. They wanted to gradually bring the wages of these newer workers up to those of the longer-tenured workers over time. The company refused. They ended up compromising. The two-tier system is going to remain in effect, but the gap between the higher and lower paid employees is closing.
Thank you, Rick. Next, I spoke with reporter Rick Barrett, who covers manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture. Here's Rick on what this year looked like in terms of what he covers.
One of the things I really enjoy about my job the most is the variety of things that I get to cover. And it's just so interesting to me because it's everything from mining equipment companies and manufacturing to dairy farming to motorcycles, the telecom industry. You know, it's just such a cool mix of things that I have the really enjoyable privilege of being able to cover. If you look at manufacturing this year, it just started as an example. It was a very interesting, challenging year for a lot of companies. You know, I can clearly remember one time this year I was talking with a guy in a manufacturing company, and he described it kind of like this. He said, there was a time when orders were just pouring in and they were so busy they couldn't keep up with it. And then the phones just stopped ringing and everything went dead. And it was hard to explain or even describe it, but you know, they waited and waited and waited, and then it picked back up again and took off. And some of that I think was true for many different companies. It was all out as fast as they could go, as hard as they could go, and then business would just fall off a cliff, and then it would come back, and then it would fall off. It was that kind of year for a lot of companies. And also for the people they worked with, it's just so difficult. I mean, there are people in the mining equipment business in this community who've been laid off now for a couple of years, and they don't even know when they're going to come back to work. There's just no sense of it being next month or even next year. And it's very hard for them to plan their lives around that.
Based on what you've seen and covered this year, what might make headlines in 2016?
I think what most people who I talk with are hoping for stability in 2016. They're tired of being whipsawed. And it's just been so uncertain this past year, and I think they're looking just for some calmer waters so they can make plans, you know, have some modest growth in the company, and for their employees just to know that, you know, they can get on with their lives a little bit better.
What would you like to add, Rick?
I think the biggest issue for many people, and one of the things that I would like to dig into deeper next year, is how do they navigate their careers and how do they navigate their lives given what they've been through in many cases. There's so many difficult choices that people have to make these days in terms of their career and how it affects everything. So I'm looking forward to that, and hopefully coming up with stories that will help people and can genuinely give them some direction and some hope, and not just tell them what they already know, that life is really unpredictable and very hard.
Thank you, Rick. You can find our coverage on the stories mentioned in these interviews and more at jsonline.com.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Brianne for all of her efforts with our podcasts over the past few weeks. Sadly, her time in the newsroom has come to an end, but many, myself in particular, are grateful for the time and effort she's put in. There are a few contentious elections coming up in 2016. Reporter Chelsea Lewis talked to political reporter Jason Stein about some of these campaigns and what voters can expect to hear from candidates in the coming months.
We have a few big races coming up in the spring, statewide and in Milwaukee. Can you speak a little bit about, let's start with the state race. Can you speak a little bit about the state Supreme Court race and what voters can expect there?
You have a recent appointee to the court, Rebecca Bradley, who is being challenged by two other judges, Joe Donald, Milwaukee County, and appellate court Judge Joanne Kloppenburg. Joanne Kloppenburg has generally been seen as a candidate aligned with Democrats, and Bradley generally aligned with Republicans or conservatives. And this race, you know, Kloppenburg did run for the court one other time. And, you know, this comes at a time when the court has increasingly found itself at the center of, you know, the kind of partisan politics and ideological battles that are cropping up in other parts of Wisconsin politics.
So let's move to the Milwaukee mayoral election. We have Tom Barrett, who's seeking a fourth term. What is he saying about why he should be reelected?
I think Mayor Barrett is, you know, a formidable candidate in terms of his fundraising, in terms of his experience on the job. He's arguing that, he's made progress in a difficult at times to govern city, and that he ought to be given a chance to continue the work that he's doing, that his job is not yet done. That's his argument.
And he's up against two aldermen in Milwaukee, Davis and Donovan. What kinds of criticisms will they throw at Barrett and making an argument that they should be elected?
Obviously, Milwaukee has experienced problems with crime, problems with violent crime in recent months. That's been part of the critique of the mayor. There also, it has been over the proposed Milwaukee streetcar. There has been, for literally for years now, a back and forth about, you know, how that was handled, whether or not that is the right way for the city to grow. And there's a host of other issues. Obviously, we just, as a city and state, took significant steps to keep a pro basketball team, the Milwaukee Bucks. There's unemployment in Milwaukee. You know, there's a range of issues to talk about in that race.
Moving to another Milwaukee race, the county executive race, you have the incumbent Chris Abley, who will be running against State Senator Chris Larson. Kind of one of the stories here is the amount of money being spent on this election. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Right. Obviously, Chris Abley is independently wealthy through family assets. He has so far shown himself willing to spend aggressively to keep his position as the top elected official in Milwaukee County. He's being challenged. Although Abley is a Democrat, he has at times worked with Republicans in the state legislature to get his agenda done. He has clashed with liberals on the county board, and he's being challenged to his left by a state senator, Chris Larson, who comes out of the county board and who has support from groups such as unions that have sometimes tangled with, public employee unions that have sometimes tangled with Abley.
To keep tabs on the upcoming elections, visit jsonline.com/politics. I'd also suggest following Jason on Twitter at JasonMDStein. Brewers fans had a bit of a painful season last year. Sadly, beat writer Tom Hodricourt doesn't think this year will be much better. The team is in a bit of a rebuilding period at the moment, but if fans can hang on, they may see a playoff-worthy team in coming years. Here's Tom with more.
Now, the Brewers had a bit of a rough season last year. What areas do you see that they need to improve in, and how are they going about trying to address those areas?
Well, what the Brewers did was start a massive rebuilding project after they got off to a horrible start in 2015. They had a terrible April, fired the manager, Ron Reneke, replaced him with Craig Counsell, and it became obvious at that time that what they were doing wasn't going to work, and so they decided to start, not from scratch, but to do a pretty big reboot of their roster. So they started trading veterans in July. They've continued to do it after the season. So their goal this winter is just to get as much young talent as possible. They've got a lot of gaps to fill in until they get some of their minor league prospects to the major leagues. So they've got the long view right now. This isn't so much about 2016 as it is beyond.
What do you think we can expect to see in 2016 then? Is it going to be a really young team that isn't cohesive, or do you think they're going to be able to give us a kind of full package of a team?
Well, it's definitely going to be younger and inexperienced. They don't have many veterans left as we speak. You have Ryan Braun in right field, Jonathan Lucroy behind the plate, and one of their starting pitchers, Matt Garza. Those are really the only three players they have that have many years in the major leagues. They have some players like Gene Segura. Their shortstop has played a few years, but not many. And so we're just going to start seeing them look at what works and doesn't work. And basically what they're going to be doing throughout 2016 and beyond is decide who the keepers are and who the non-keepers are, the ones that just have to move on and they'll try somebody else.
And are there any young players that you're particularly excited about?
Well, they have many prospects in their farm system that will give Brewers fans reason to get excited about. They, through trades and some pretty good drafts the last year or so, they've really restocked their farm system. And that's kind of what they're going to be doing in 2016, kind of plugging gaps until they can get these guys up there. But players that the fans will want to look for in the next year, 2 years, and even beyond, shortstop Orlando Arcia. He played in Double-A this year, and he is considered one of the top prospects in all of baseball. Very exciting offensive and defensive player. They traded Luchison and got a center hitter named Brett Phillips. He's also an exciting offensive and defensive player, probably a leadoff type hitter and a good defender in center. He has star quality. The right-hander Jorge Lopez was their minor league pitcher of the year last year. He also pitched in Double-A. If you're seeing a trend here, a lot of their prospects are in Double-A, and that's why they're going to be filling some gaps in 2016 with other players until these guys are ready, these younger players, these prospects are ready to get to the major league.
And as we inch closer to the spring, keep an eye out for more Brewers coverage from Tom. That's available at jsonline.com/sports. And that does it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. If you're not subscribed to this show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, make it a New Year's resolution to do so. All of us here at the Journal Sentinel are excited for another year of taking you behind the headlines in our newsroom. Cheers to 2016.